I know it was a mistake. I didn't plan it. It just happened. She was freaked out about the director. He called her Dominique. It's been building up with her. She needed a connection. She's been under a lot of pressure. She needed a connection, said Gable from his usual seat on the couch behind Nate. Is that what your generation calls scrogging now? Forsythe's normally kindly, patrician face was dark. His eyes held Nate's until the younger man looked down. Then you address her needs, you talk her down, you give her support, but you don't... Go at it like minx, said Gable. Yeah, minx, said Forsythe. What happens if your relationship hits a bump? What if you have a fight in 4 months and she decides she can't stand you? Easy to see it happening, said Gable. Is she going to keep working for the CIA, or is she doing all this because she's besotted with your... Macho gazpacho, said Gable. What the fuck are you talking about, said Forsythe, looking at Gable slouched on the couch. He turned back to Nate, who had laughed at Gable's comment. Come on, Nate, he said. Despite the intelligence she's provided at this point, and despite her poly, D.Va is a new asset. We need to see her operate productively before we know your recruitment took. Does that mean we don't trust her? Yes and no. You never totally trust any agent. Russians get morose, they get dramatic, they get homesick, they get nutty. Remember Yurchenko waving goodbye on the steps of the Aeroflot flight? D.Va's strong, but we all know she's temperamental, impulsive. He held up his hand to stop Gable from making a puerile comment. Your job as a case officer is to collect the intel, ensure her security, sublimate your personal emotions, and make D.Va the best agent you can. Sublimate, said Gable. That means no fucking. You've been moping since you came to station about making a big recruitment, about not losing the case, about your hall file. Well, goddammit, start running this Russian like a pro. Run her with a cool head. The one on your shoulders, said Gable. And consider what a love affair could do to the operation, to her. We've got to start thinking about her return to Moscow. We don't know the timing. She could flat refuse to work inside, so start her thinking about that grind. Prepare her for it. Yes, sir, said Nate, looking back up at Forsythe. Are we clear? Said Forsythe, bearing down a final time. I know, said Nate. I'm all over it. Thanks for the pep talk. I'll get it back on track. That's good to hear, said Gable, pushing up from the couch. Now I can yank the 4 nanny cams out of the safe house. Nate looked over at him, eyes wide. Forsythe was keeping a straight face. Just kidding, Romeo, said Gable. I couldn't bear watching the replays. What prevented Forsythe and Gable from further kicking Nate's ass over the affair was a signal from Dominica the next day. Nate studiously did not jerk his hand away when he touched the slick smear of Vaseline on the underside of his car door handle in the morning. She had wiped it on during the night. Emergency signal, he thought, plus 12 hours. The night was chilly. Scandinavian fall had arrived, with hoarfrost on windshields, steam dribbling from the vents. They were waiting at the safe house reviewing the emergency contingencies. Was she on the run? Was this a hot pursuit situation? Nate had researched the air and ferry schedules. Gable's supo guy was on standby. Archie and Veronica were sitting by the phone. All three CIA officers dealt with the waiting, the stomach feel. No one checked his watch. They were too good for that. Nate stood up when her key turned in the lock, and they knew it was okay because her ice blue eyes were sparkling and her cheeks were flushed. From not only the SDR, but also something else. Gable fetched a cup of steaming tea, and she blew on it while she told the story quickly and well. Details up front because that was how they were all trained. She wanted to rock them a little, impress them. The day before, an unidentified man had come to the Russian embassy, asked to see the security man, and had given him an envelope with block printing on it. Deliver unopened to M. Volontov. The man slipped out of the embassy before the bovine security officer could get his name, but the security officer instantly took the letter upstairs to resident Volontov, who found a second envelope inside the first. Volontov had bellowed for Dominika to come in and had hovered and fumed in a dusty orange cloud while she translated the English language note. Printed in block letters, it said that the bearer was offering a classified U.S. technical manual to the SVR for the sum of $500,000 and proposed to meet in 5 days at the Comp Hotel. Dominica looked from Nate to Forsythe to Gable, sipped her tea, kept going. There was a second page in the envelope, with three torn strips as if yanked out of a three-ring binder. Top secret, Umbra, top and bottom of the page, boldface title U.S. National Communications Grid, and upper corner trimmed diagonally. Voluntov was nervous, made her read the warning notice under the title to him twice. Unauthorized distribution. If found, return to Office of Coordination. Misuse subject to prosecution. Voluntov's face was gray. He barked at her to make a copy. His Soviet sycophant juices were flowing, and he puffily told her he was going to pouch the original title page directly to First Deputy Director Igorov. Top priority, more secure that way. Forsythe looked at Gable, and Gable was standing up, throwing on his coat, when Dominica lifted her sweater and pulled a folded piece of paper from her waistband and slid it across to Forsythe. She'd made a second copy. The Americans clustered around. Gable tapped the torn diagonal corner and muttered, "Fuckers cut out the serial number." Then looked at Dominica and said, "I thought I told you never to do that again." Then leaned over and kissed the top of her head and went out. The station's NIACT cable would be in Washington in 30 minutes. Gable liked sending night action cables and waking the donut eaters in Langley. Voluntov had been in torment the rest of the day, said Dominica. He had called her into his office half a dozen times, an orange Ferris wheel of anticipation around his head. Even he realized that this could be a colossal intelligence windfall. Near the end of the day, he decided that he would call Vanya Igorov directly to inform him of the sensitive and potentially spectacular development and to alert him to the incoming pouch. Let the deputy director see how he, Voluntov, personally was handling the operation. Voluntov shut his door to make the call on the Veche phone, and Dominica had heard the gratuitous laughter and the servility in the repeated barked, da-da-da, a real, how do you say it, she asked, buttock kisser? Close enough, said Forsythe. Voluntov summoned her for the 10th time that day and archly informed her that the deputy director, of course, had ratified Voluntov's suggestion that Dominica and only Dominica would assist the resident in this operation. She would prepare the funds. She was told to draw only $5,000. She was directed to rent the room at the comp. She would translate during the meeting with the American. Start now, he said, dismissing her with a wave. Unbeknownst to Dominica, Voluntov also called in his Line KR referent, the former border guard's prodigy. I want you to counter-surveil a meeting I'm having at the end of the week, in the lobby of the comp hotel. Just sit and watch. A meeting? Said the counterintelligence officer. How many men will we need? Of course we'll be armed. Idiot, just you. No weapons. Just sit in the lobby. Watch me meet a contact. Stay there, then watch me leave. Is that clear? Said Voluntov. The KR man nodded, but he was disappointed. Nate hustled Dominica out of the safe house after an hour. Moscow rules from now on. No unnecessary meetings, no daytime meetings. Look for surveillance, assume surveillance. Curtail ostensible social contacts. Stay close to the embassy until after the comp hotel rendezvous is complete. Voluntov would be on edge, jumpy, might draw in the strings, watch everyone. They would take no chances, no risks. There's a cobra in the toilet bowl, said Gable back in the station. We have to proceed very carefully. Anything happens to blow the meeting, anything, this shithead American gets arrested, the SVR doesn't get the manual. Dominica is the only other person in the SVR who knows about the volunteer. Forsythe sent a restricted handling cable reminding headquarters of the risk to Diva. Chief Europe, for one, was shocked to read Forsythe's recommendation that station simply identify the traitor and let the FBI settle his hash after he returned to the United States. Chief Europe could not countenance a plan that would result in the grave loss of national security information, not as long as his hand remained at the tiller of Europe Division. When the legal attaché of the American Embassy, a 52-year-old special agent of the FBI named Elwood Moratus, barged into Forsythe's office to coordinate the takedown, they knew headquarters had briefed the walk-in all over Washington. Moratus had distinguished himself during a 25-year career as a bank robbery investigator in the Midwest, and he put his feet up in the office, showing the soles of his shoes to Forsythe and Gable, and said this was a clear case of espionage committed by an American citizen, and therefore under the strict purview of the FBI. "Fucking guy," said Gable when Meredith left. "Thinks espresso means non-stop train in Spanish." It was a certainty that if they let them, a dozen FBI special agents would descend on Helsinki wearing cargo pants, tactical boots, and New York Yankees ball caps. All the station could do would be to try to keep the Phoebes under control. Forsythe told Nate to have the exfiltration plan for Diva spun up and ready. They might have to get her out if there was a flap and the Russians started looking for reasons why. Then something happened in headquarters. There must have been a big meeting, and they started paying attention to the danger to Diva. Some later said it was Simon Benford, chief of counterintelligence, who threw one of his well-known histrionic fits, warning that inattention to the counterintelligence threat to this agent would ensure a pig's breakfast. The result was two cables that arrived on the third day, 2 days before the meeting at the comp. The first was tagged, "From Chief Europe Direct for COS." The second had been drafted by Benford with characteristic economy bordering on rudeness. That cable proposed an operational gambit that astounded even Marty Gable, an old whore who had an ashtray in his office made from a human skull from either Cambodia or Miami. He claimed he could not remember which. The first cable read, 1. Please confine future traffic on reference information to this channel. Appreciate Ref. HQ's assigns top priority to preventing the potential illegal sale to SVR of U.S. classified material. Station directed to coordinate with Embassy FBI representative, who has been briefed by FBI HQ's in Washington. HQ's confirms to station that FBI has primacy in all investigatory and law enforcement matters involving threats to the national security and MSIT suspected of a federal crime per Title II of the Intelligence Reform Act of 2004, and Executive Order 12333 and 50 USC 401. 2. Request station fully support FBI investigation as required. HQ's, of course, is concerned that any arrest could affect security of station asset, GT Diva. Submit station should increase measures to vouchsafe Diva's operational security. 3. Please report developments by immediate precedence cable. HQ standing by to assist as required. Fair winds and smooth sailing. The second cable read, 1. Reference GT Diva report received. Diva developing into exceptional source. 2. Please express HQ's compliments. 3. Concur that even slight misstep in dealing with Ref volunteer will put scrutiny on Diva. In event worst case outcome, please ensure exfil contingency plan is in place. HQ's prepared for defector processing and resettlement. 4. FBI law enforcement equities notwithstanding, HQ's goals are to identify volunteer, effect his arrest, and permit report permit SVR to take receipt of manual without raising Russian CI suspicions. FBI will be briefed on covert action opportunity and will follow station direction to achieve CA goals. 5. For station background, separate DOD compartmented program last year produced modified manual, GT Solar, identical to copy offered for sale in Helsinki. Exact nature modifications classified will result in technical disinformation and misdirection. 6. Ident OSWR researcher couriering Solar manual departing Washington evening 17th, expected arrival morning of 18th. Please meet and accommodate. 7. Submit ASAP operational proposal to substitute Solar manual by immediate precedence. Disregard guidance in previous cable. They worked it out, called in the techs, called one more meeting with Diva on the night before the contact. They showed her the drawings, copied her hotel room key, ran her through the steps, made her look at the drawings again. "It's all right, Nate," she said. An edge to her voice, nerves showing. Talked about the risk, her exposure, but she didn't want to hear it. Her blue eyes searched his face when he rolled out the map, marking the corner where they would pick her up if she was on the run. She heard the concern in his voice. Was this about her, she thought, or about the operation? Nate, the handler, was back, his aura unchanged. Things were too serious, so they broke for a late dinner, and it was Forsythe's turn. He didn't cook much, but Dominica gaped at him in an apron, bathed in blue, wearing oven mitts, pulling a saucier out of the oven. He knew one dish, a soubise, buttery braised rice and caramelized onions. In case of disaster, and so they wouldn't starve, Gable had bought lamb kebabs from a takeout place. They ate without talking. Then a look at the clock. She'd better get home. She didn't open the door, waited a beat, pulling up her collar. "Good luck tomorrow," she said. "And she's the one under the blade," thought Nate. "You too," said Nate. "This is going to be fine." "See you in a couple of days," she said, pulling on a pair of gloves, ready to open the door. Waiting, sounds of dishes in the sink, looking at him, Mona Lisa smile. "I want you to be careful," he said. She looked over his shoulder toward the little moon-blasted bedroom, but he didn't blink, and her heart fell a little. "Spokojnoj noci, Nate." She never made a sound going down the steps. They walked around putting out the lamps, getting ready to go home. It was already tomorrow. Forsythe was talking as they buttoned up the apartment. No ripples, no hovering, no heroics, is that clear? Gable was drawing the curtains, flicking off the light in the bathroom. "Got it," said Nate. "I mean, if we hit a bump tomorrow, we don't launch in spec war mode," Forsythe said. "Right, I understand," said Nate, knowing what was coming, trying not to patronize his chief. "If there's trouble, what we do is assess the trouble. Then we make the decision to act. But it is going to be critical that Dominica play out her role in the exchange to sell the swap. If she stumbles, no matter what the reason, the operation is gone." Gable came back into the room. "By this time tomorrow, the SVR has got to be jerking one another off if they got away with the authentic goods. No doubts, sheer joy in Moscow." They were all pulling on their overcoats. What had to be said now, because once outside on the street, they walked away in different directions, no goodnight hugs. "So what I'm hearing is that we let her walk into a shitstorm to sell the con," said Nate, trying to keep his voice even.
"Sell the con," said Gable. "This isn't Las Vegas. We're going to protect her every way we know how, but you got to get on board, Nugget. Get your head straight. This is as big as it gets."
The three of them split up in the frosty air. Nate took the long walk around to his car. Trolleys weren't running that late. He felt a little of the Vaseline still under his door handle, and he got into his car and stared at the dashboard, and his vision tunneled, and he was parking in front of her apartment and pounding on her door, and she was in his arms, her nightgown clinging and thin over her body, and she was showering him with kisses, and his cloudy vision popped, and he shook his head clear and started his car and drove home, looping around the fringes of the city, watching his mirrors. Forsythe Soubise. Boil rice in salted water for 5 minutes. In separate French saucière, lightly caramelize seasoned onions and butter. Stir in rice, cover, and cook gently in medium oven, stirring occasionally until golden. Before serving, stir in heavy cream and grated Gruyère. Chapter 20. Forsythe, Nate, and a tech named Ginsburg perched gingerly on the red velvet Empire chairs in an elegant room at the Comp Hotel. They looked skeptically at the flocked silk wallpaper and satin canopy over the bed. Traffic noise on Nora Esplanaden came faintly through the shears across the tall French doors. The three CIA officers sat around a low gilt side table, which was covered by two laptops, a cell phone, a miniature signal receiver, and an encrypted Motorola SB5100. The bulky radios were more secure than cell phones, especially in the likely event that the Russians were monitoring all channels during the hotel room meeting. The laptops displayed two images. Number one was of Dominika's room in the comp, essentially identical to the one they were sitting in. It was in fact the room next door. Laptop number two showed the interior of that room's large adjoining bathroom. Both images were from an upper corner, near the ceiling. A bird's-eye 270-degree view. Per Voluntov's instructions, Dominika had rented the room several days in advance, which gave the techs time to do an entry. The station had worked overnight to install two wireless cameras, one mortised into the ornate plaster ceiling molding of the bedroom, the other secured inside a forced air vent in the bathroom. The cameras transmitted an encrypted signal to the receiver that was then displayed on and recorded by the laptops. Each remote head camera, the size of a Zippo lighter, also contained a miniature digital microphone that provided audio. Gable was on the street in a parked van at the front of the comp with Legat Meritus and three other special agents from the FBI's counter-espionage office in Washington. To Meritus's barely concealed fury, Forsythe had vetoed any FBI presence in the hotel room, partly to contain and control the Phoebes, but mostly to prevent them from seeing Dominika. They were not going to expose her as an asset to the Phoebes. The Phoebes had played hardball in Washington. They refused to agree to permit the volunteer, whoever he was, to depart Helsinki and return to the United States before they popped him. Too many things could go wrong, they argued. What they really meant was that they couldn't survive the political blowback if the unsub, the unknown subject, got away. Cake eaters and headquarters therefore agreed that the Phoebes would wait till the Russians had cleared the area before taking him down. They said sure when the CIA insisted that Forsythe, and only Forsythe, would give the go-ahead to arrest. "Everybody understands the sequence of events, right?" said Forsythe in his office the day before. He was looking pointedly at Meritas. "Yeah, we got it. This isn't our first bust," said Meritas. "Just be sure you call us when you find out the little cocksucker's name. Elwood, I want to stress that you have to wait for my go signal. You'll put my source's life in jeopardy if you go in too hard too soon," said Forsythe. Meritus looked up at Forsythe in annoyance. "I said I got it. Jesus, I got it." Gable had told Nate that his job for this operation was to shut up and listen, but Nate spoke up anyway, looking directly at the FBI man. "If you guys fuck this up, better have your wife start your car every morning." It was a howling breach of etiquette. "You little shit," said Meritus. "Is that a threat against a federal officer?" Nate had been about to respond when Forsythe said, "Shut the fuck up, both of you." Meritus thought to say something else, but kept his mouth shut. The radio on the table clicked twice, the signal from Gable in the van that Voluntov and Dominika had entered the hotel lobby. 3 minutes later, laptop one showed the door opening and Voluntov, Dominika, and a short man entering the room. Dominika carried a briefcase. The volunteer was dark-complexioned and had an unruly shock of black hair and heavy eyebrows. He wore a blue windbreaker and carried a black duffel bag slung over his shoulder. What the camera did not record was what Dominika saw. The air around him was suffused with a soiled yellow cast like a fever wind, or the sky before a tornado. She knew what Voluntov was going to do to him. Dominika knew the young man was lost. They sat in chairs around a low table. The audio picked up Voluntov speaking in Russian and Dominika translating. It was eerie to hear Dominika's voice coming out of the laptop. At Voluntov's insistence, the young man identified himself as John Paul Bullard, a mid-level analyst in the National Communications Service. He described his work and his need for money. He patted the duffel bag and repeated his demand that Voluntov pay him $500,000 for the manual, the cover sheet of which he had already provided. Voluntov spoke again, and Dominika asked the young American how they could be sure it was genuine. Bullard zipped open the duffel and handed Dominika a bound manual the size of a thin telephone book. She handed it to Voluntov, who spent 3 seconds riffling the pages before he handed it back to Dominika. He said something to Bullard that Dominica translated. They would have to examine the document privately before determining its exact value. Bullard said, "It's genuine, all right. It's the real thing." At Voluntat's nod, Dominica got up from the chair with the document and the briefcase and walked into the bathroom. Per his detailed instructions the day before, the resident wanted the manual and the false bottom of the briefcase as soon as possible in case this was a Western provocation, a trap. The windowless bathroom was the place to secure it. Forsythe whispered into the radio. "All okay. Hold." Laptop 2 showed the bathroom door opening and Dominica's head filled the screen. She closed the door, placed the briefcase on the bathroom vanity. Moving quickly, she bent to the floor and pushed the kick plate of the vanity, which opened inward on 3 piano hinges. Dominica pulled an identical-looking manual, modified under a microscope by a score of eggheads and meticulously prepared, down to the missing cover page, out of the concealment cavity and pushed Bullard's original manual into the space. The hinged kick plate swung closed. Dominica pressed 2 rivets in the lid of the briefcase. With the pressure, the inside lining of the briefcase opened to reveal a false bottom, into which Dominica put the modified replacement manual. She snapped the concealment cover closed and shut the briefcase lid with a click. Dominica paused to look at herself in the mirror, patted her hair, and then looked up at the vent and into the invisible camera. Nate, the evening before, had told her they would be monitoring the switch to ensure everything went smoothly. Dominica stuck her tongue out at the camera, and with a last look at herself in the mirror, went back out into the bedroom. "Jesus Christ," said Maritas. "Unbelievable. What kind of operation are you running?"
"Can I get her number?" said Ginsburg, the tech.
"Shut up, both of you," said Forsythe. Dominica sat down again as Voluntov dug into his coat pocket and took out a fat envelope. He placed it on the table and slid it across to Bullard. Dominica told Bullard that they could pay him only $5,000 until they had verified the authenticity of the manual. Bullard's look of astonishment was met with stony-faced silence from Voluntov.
"What's he gonna do?" said Ginsburg. "Go to the authorities?"
A sharp look from Forsythe shut him up. Dominica told Bullard that they would leave first and that he should wait in the room for 5 minutes before exiting the hotel. The young American sat back in his chair, gobsmacked. Voluntov stood up, buttoned his coat, and walked out of the room, Dominica following him. Alone now, the American leaned forward with his face in his hands. Forsythe was whispering into the radio, repeating Bullard's name twice. "Party's over, guests still upstairs, no one move, no movement." 2 clicks of acknowledgement came back. Suddenly, Bullard straightened and stood up. "Sit the fuck down," Forsythe said to the screen on the laptop. "Stay put, you little bastard." Bullard walked to the door and left the room. Forsythe grabbed the radio. "Guest is moving. Blue windbreaker, black duffel. All still hold. Do not move." Voluntov and Dominica walked out of the hotel and into an embassy car waiting at the curb. The FBI men watched them go and made to get out of the van. "Sit tight, you guys," said Gable. "No go yet from upstairs." "Fuck this," said one of the FBI agents. "The Russians are gone. Let's take this prick down." Gable grabbed the arm of one of the agents.
"No one's going anywhere until we get the okay," he said.
"Get the fuck out of the way," said Meritus as he slid the van door open. The FBI agents piled out of the van and ran into the hotel. The elevator doors opened and Bullard walked out into the lobby in his blue windbreaker and into the arms of 3 FBI agents who forced him to the ground, wrenched his arms behind his back, and slapped on a pair of cuffs. A crowd of hotel guests and tourists gathered around as the FBI agents pulled Bullard to his feet and frog-marched him out of the lobby. In the commotion, no one noticed the KR man from the Russian embassy standing in the back of the crowd. He turned and left the hotel by a side entrance. Forsythe packed up the equipment as Nate retrieved Bullard's manual from the meeting room bathroom, and the tech hurriedly removed the cameras from the corner of the ceiling and the bathroom vent. They all met back at the station. "God damn it," fumed Forsythe. "I'm going to rip Maritas his nuts off. It was too soon, too goddamn soon."
"You'll have to wait till he gets back to town," said Gable. "They headed straight to the airport. They had a G waiting to fly the guy right back to Washington. Those assholes all had woodies. They were so excited. They were already thinking about their promotions. "You think the Russians had anyone covering the lobby?" said Nate. He was fighting down the dread in his guts.
"Impossible to tell," said Gable. "There were a lot of people watching the arrest. If it were me, I'd have somebody hanging around."
"Great," said Nate. "I'm going to the safe house to wait for Dominica. Call me if you hear anything." He got up to leave.
"Hold it," said Forsythe. "Sit down for a second."
Nate sat down.
"I want you to keep calm, you understand? No going over to her apartment, no phone calls, not one. No putting up signals, no checking her sights. If I see you within 5 blocks of the Russian embassy, I'm going to tear your nuts off right after I do Maritas."
He looked at Nate for a long beat.
"You understand me, Nate?"
"Yes. I'm going to the safe house to wait, that's all. This is just the kind of situation we discussed. We don't know what, if anything, the Russians saw. I'm sending a cable right now to Washington with the entire picture, and I hope they assign Maritas to Topeka, cataloging safe deposit box signature cards for the rest of his career."
Nate stood to leave, his face showing his anger and fear.
"Sit down. I'm not finished," said Forsythe. "Now comes the hard part. Waiting for word that your agent is safe. If you move too soon, you might jeopardize her even if they suspect nothing. We have to let this play out."
"How about putting Archie and Veronica on her apartment?" asked Gable, a suggestion more for Nate's benefit than anything else.
"No, I don't want to risk even that," said Forsythe.
"But Marty, I do want you to have your Supo boy hang around the lookout on Tetankhatu Street to keep an eye on the Russians. Anything strange coming in or out of the embassy, he should call. Promise him a bonus."
Nate stood to leave.
"Stay cool," Forsythe said.
The instant he stepped into the safe house, Nate could smell Dominica in the air, a whiff of soap and powder over something more elemental, woody and sharp. For a minute, he thought she'd already arrived at the apartment, but there was nobody there. They had told her to stay away for a day and a night. Valentov would be flying high, sending cables and making calls. He would need her near him. Nate walked into the bedroom and lay on the bed. He fell asleep in his clothes, waking in the middle of the night to drag the bedspread over him. The smell of her on the bedclothes filled his lungs. The sunlight woke him up. Gable was in the kitchen, making coffee.
"Everything's cool," he said. "Nothing strange, nothing out of the ordinary. One thing, don't tell Forsythe, but I sent Veronica to ring her doorbell late last night. No one's home. Looks like she didn't sleep there. The Ruskies probably pulled an all-nighter."
Nate went to the sink and splashed water on his face. His chest felt tight. The container with a single dumpling was still in the refrigerator. He looked at the crimped pocket of dough that she had made with her fingers. Gable was making an omelet on the stove, but Nate was too edgy to eat.
"No one knows how to make a real omelet," said Gable. "It's not just cooking eggs and folding them over. That's bullshit. You have to shake the pan and stir to get the curds small. You listening? Get them smooth, and form them in front of the pan like this."
He gathered the cooked eggs lightly with a fork, reversed his grip on the skillet handle, tapped it on the stove, and inverted the pan over a plate. Gable's omelet was a pale yellow teardrop of softly cooked eggs.
"And the fucking center still has to be runny," Gable said, cutting it open with a fork. "You want some?"
"Jesus, Marty," said Nate.
"Look, all we can do is wait to see what happens. Not a peep from our side, no movement."
He ate a forkful of omelet.
"Let me ask you a question. What's the most important aspect about this clam bake?" he asked.
"You mean the manual, the substitution?" said Nate.
"Fuck the manual. What about our agent? They might have Dominica in a chair in the basement right now, and you're eating omelets."
"I want her safe as much as you do," said Gable. "But we wait to see if the Russians believe they pulled off stealing the manual. We wait to hear them slapping themselves on the back. The fort is looking in real time at the residentura traffic. Dominica's thumb drive download took. It's giving us everything, and NSA is reading it all. Total radio silence, but that could mean they're being extra careful.
And if we lose the agent? Is it worth it?"
"You figure it out.
We make the Bolshies waste 7 years planning cyber attacks against what they think is our infrastructure for nothing. What's more important? Nate looked over at Gable, who was staring back at him. Enjoy your fucking omelet, said Nate. Forsythe looked up from his desk in the station at midday. Gable had just heard from his guy who had spent the morning watching from the OP. Nate didn't like the way Gable's face looked. A van left the Russian embassy at 9 o'clock this morning, Diva and two others. They were carrying a diplomatic bag and headed to the airport. There's an Aeroflot flight to Moscow every day at noon, said Gable, looking at his watch. That's in 90 minutes.
That's it? Said Nate.
What are we going to do about it?
What we're going to do about it is absolutely nothing, said Forsythe. The van going to the airport is normal. The first thing they'd do all last night is copy the damn thing and prepare the pouch. Now they're bringing the original back in the bag on the noon flight. Dominika and two escorts. Valentov would do something like that, send her to kiss ass and get the credit.
We don't know that, said Nate. What if they're escorting her back? What if she's in trouble?
Even if that's true, what do you suggest? Asked Forsythe.
The manual is going to get to Moscow.
Let me go to the airport, said Nate. I won't fuck around, I'll just scope it out. Maybe we'll get a feel for what's happening. We'd like to know what the situation looks like, wouldn't we? We'd like to be able to report the details, right?
No fucking way, said Forsythe. You'd be like Romeo yelling for Juliet to come out on the balcony.
Nate looked over at Gable.
I can't stand this, said Gable. Any second this dickhead's going to start weeping.
Tom, I'll go with him. I won't let him step on his dick. We might see who she's traveling with, get an indication of what's going on.
Gable looked at Forsythe and nodded.
When Forsythe didn't say anything, Nate and Gable threw on their coats and pounded down the stairs. With Nate at the wheel, the drive to the airport was on two wheels. They walked along the glassed-in observation mezzanine that overlooked the departure hall. Gable spotted Dominika sitting close to the Aeroflot gate. She was dressed in the same navy suit and white shirt. Her hair was tied with a ribbon. An embassy official sat on either side of her. The yellow canvas diplomatic bag was on the floor between one of the official's knees. Dominika looked small and quiet, dressed like a good little functionary returning to Moscow and the center. Gable grabbed Nate by the collar and hustled him behind a broad pillar.
Just stand there, no waving, no movement. If she sees you, we don't know how she'll react. If you fuck up, you could kill her.
Dominika sat between the Residentura security man and an embassy admin flunky who, when told he was getting a free round trip home, packed his suitcase full of tinned salmon and music CDs to sell to his neighbors and friends in Moscow. He didn't even know who the busty young bonbon sitting next to him was, and he didn't care. The security man on the other side had received whispered instructions about this trip. He was told only that Corporal Igorova would be met at the airport by officials, and that he was to turn over the bag directly to the same officers. He was to get a signed receipt for the bag and was granted 2 days' leave before he returned to Helsinki. Period. Dominika was enveloped in the overpowering double wash of the security man's cologne and the gagging smell of cooked cabbage from the admin sloth. Something caught her eye and she looked up at the observation mezzanine. Standing beside a column in the glass wall was Nate. He stood looking down at her, his hands by his sides, the glass tinted purple. Her breath caught in her chest. She willed herself to stay still. Their eyes met, and she gave an imperceptible shake of her head. No, Dushka. She willed her thought to reach him through the glass. Let me go. Nate looked down at her and nodded. Gable's proper French omelet. Beat eggs with salt and pepper. When butter in pan over high heat has stopped foaming, pour eggs in. Violently stir eggs while shaking pan until eggs begin to scramble. Tilt pan forward to pile eggs at front. Run fork around edges to fold into the still wet center, ensuring ends of the omelet come to a point. Change to underhanded grip, tap pan to bring omelet to lip of skillet, and invert pan onto plate. Omelet should be pale yellow and creamy inside.
Chapter 21. Voluntov didn't look at her when he told Dominique he wanted a summary translation of Bullard's manual, but the air around his head was suffused with a dark orange cloud. Deception, mistrust, danger. She could feel it. She would have to stay in the embassy overnight. She could sleep on the couch in the day room next to Records. The resident KR thug kept her in his sight the whole time. She was unaware that he had observed the flurry of men pulling the volunteer Bullard to the marble floor of the comp lobby, tourists milling, but her intuition told her something was seriously wrong. Voluntov looked at her from across the room, and she felt the acid of the old days, the look of Stalin's hangman Dzerzhinsky, Yezhov, Beria, the blank, bloodless look that sent men and women to the cellars. Dominika knew something had happened. She fought a rising surge of panic. They were keeping their distance, always a bad sign. The machinery of distrust had kicked in. Dominika resolved to act as if nothing had happened, to assume an air of innocence. She thought about the safe house, about Nate and Bratok, and she told herself to stop thinking about them, to prepare for what was coming. She began bricking up her mind, burying the secrets as deeply as she could. They mustn't get at her secrets, no matter how deep they dug. Two gray men met them at the Sheremetyevo, standing shoulder to shoulder in the middle of the terminal. They took the dun-yellow canvas pouch from the security man, who then left the terminal in a separate car. They told her she was required at an interview, walked on either side of her to the waiting car. She rode in silence from the airport in the late afternoon light to a nondescript building in the eastern end of the city. It was off Ryazansky Prospect was all she could see. A creaking lift, a long corridor painted green, and she sat there as daylight faded to night. She had not eaten, and she had worn the same clothes for 2 days. A man with glasses opened a door and gestured her to enter a room that was made to look like a private office, but it was unlived in, a stage set, down to the bowl of roses on the sideboard. The man had thin hands, pianist's hands. He was bald with a dent in the side of his head, as if from a trepanning that remarkably also bent and distorted the yellow bubble around his head. Jelti, the familiar yellow of treachery and betrayal. He welcomed Dominika back to Moscow. It was always good to return to Moskva, was it not? They were pleased, he said, with her work in Scandinavia, especially with the handling of the volunteer. No, not Jelti, but Jeltizna. The man was yellowness itself. This was deception, this was danger, mortal danger, she could smell it. She had to hit the right attitude, curious, a little puzzled, tired from the trip. Above all, for God's sake, no hint of fear, no hint of desperation. Was there a problem, she asked? Was she permitted to know his name, rank, and directorate? She assumed he was a colleague from the service, Colonel Dygtyar, Directorate K, yes, of course, from the center, Dygtyar. Ukrainian, she thought. The overhead lights cast a shadow on the hollow of his skull. She related the timeline of the operation from the walk-in to the hotel meeting. No, she was unaware that there had been an incident. She knew nothing about an apparent arrest after she and the resident had departed the comp. Resident Voluntov had not mentioned anything was wrong. Dygtyar did not take notes, did not refer to any file. They were taping it all, looking at her face, watching her hands. She resisted the urge to look for where the cameras could be. Don't look, don't think, no one can help you. You have to do this yourself. This is your journey to make alone. They took her passport and let her go home that night. Her mother came to the front door in her dressing gown, initially surprised, but it took less than a second for her face to close down, her eyes to become blank. Dominushka, what a surprise, come in. Let me look at you. I did not know you were coming home. Her mother said flatly. Caution. It was an unexpected trip, said Dominika in as normal a voice as possible. It's good to be home, Mama. It's good to see you again. Danger. Mother and daughter hugged. They kissed each other's cheeks the requisite 3 times and hugged again. Dominika did not dare clutch her. She could not break down. They might be watching, listening. Mother and daughter stayed up, and Dominica prattled on about the Finns, about life abroad. She had to sleep. She had to work in the morning. Another kiss, and her mother stroked her cheek, then shuffled off to bed. She knew. They picked her up in the morning and deposited her back at Ryazanskaya, and she told the story again, this time to three men sitting at a table with the bowl of roses in front of them, probably an audio pickup tucked among the flowers. No one spoke, but they turned the pages in an unmarked file. Had that pig Volontov sent in a report that quickly? They filed out and left her alone, then filed back in, and she told the story again, just the same. They were looking for changes, contradictions. Dominica had never been stared at like that in her life. Worse than in ballet school, worse even than the men looking at her at Sparrow School. She felt her throat constrict, felt the rage coming, but resisted and returned their stares with unflinching eyes. She did not let them near the icy secret in her breast. All day it lasted. Then she was permitted to go home. Her mother had a rich meat stew in the oven. The smell of dacha and vegetables and memories of snowy mornings filled the apartment. Dominika's hand shook as she ate, her mother not eating, sitting across from her, watching. She knew. Her mother had not played professionally in 15 years, but got up and came back to the kitchen with a case. It was a common violin, nothing like her Guarneri, but she sat close to her daughter at the table and put it under her chin and played slowly. Schumann or Schubert, Dominica didn't know. The violin vibrated, the notes thick and rich and red-purple, like long ago in the living room with Batushka. "Your father was always very proud of you," said her mother as she played. Was she consciously playing to defeat any microphones? Impossible. Her mother? "He always hoped that your enthusiasms, your patriotic duty, would sustain you." Her eyes were closed. He was desperate to tell you how he felt. He who had succeeded in the system, but he did not dare. He did not speak because he wanted to protect you. She opened her eyes but continued playing, as if in a trance, her fingers firm and sure on the fingerboard. "He despised them," he would tell you now in your time of trouble. What had she guessed? How did she know? "His whole life he wanted to tell you. Now I will tell you," her mother whispered. "Resist them. Fight them. Survive." With the last word she stopped playing and laid the violin on the table, got up, kissed her daughter on the head, and walked out of the room. The music lingered in the air. The violin was warm where it had rested beneath her mother's chin. The next day, a succession of offices with one man or two or three, or a woman in a suit with her hair in a bun, cloudy black and evil, who came around the desk to sit close to her, or Colonel Dygtyar with the yellow caved-in skull, asking her to describe the pattern of the rug in the room of the Comp Hotel, and the doors sometimes closing softly behind her, sometimes slammed with a bang that shook the frame. "We don't believe you." Then the unbelievable, the monstrous, the impossible, the inevitable. A poisonous swaying ride in the closed van, and the echo of the underground garage, and they were in a prison. It had to be Lefortovo, not Bertokia, because this was political. She was pushed down an ill-lit corridor into a stinking anteroom. A man and a woman watched her step out of her skirt, shuck off her shoes, and reach behind to unclasp her brassiere. They expected her to hang her head, to turn away from their stares, to cover her nipples and mons. But she was Sparrow-trained and a graduate of the AVR. They could go to hell. Stark naked, she stood straight and stared back at them until they tossed her a stained cotton prison smock. It rasped against the mattress, ticking in the dark cell, no windows, two cots, and she thought about her mother waiting for her with dinner, and silently called out to her father, and then, surprising herself, to Nate. They walked her down the corridors, but they never let her see another prisoner, to starve her spirit. Guards clicked their stamped steel crickets, and when two crickets clicked, silver-barbed click-clack, click-clack at the same time, they shoved her into a wooden closet, one at the end of each corridor wedged tight, black and heavy with the smell of prisoners long gone, until the other prisoner went by. A skylight showed inky black or pale yellow. Night still followed day, but the overhead lights in her cell never stopped humming, and the klaxons screeched on a regular basis. Her father walked by her side, and a smiling Nate was waiting for her in each of the different rooms, some hot, some cold, some dark, some bright. She shook her hair out of her eyes when they threw water on her and turned the blowers on. Nate sat beside her and held her hand, strapped to the arm of the chair while she shivered. They didn't speak to her, but it was enough to know that they were with her, to feel their touch. The investigators screamed or they laughed very close to her face, and they asked about foreign contacts, the Frenchman Delon and the American Nash. Was she working for the Americans? It was no problem these days, by the way, détente and all. They said they wanted to hear her side of the story, then slapped her to shut her up and told her Marta Yelenova was dead, that Dominika had as good as killed her. Men would be sent to do the same to her mother. They slapped her so her face was mottled and sore. All little sparrows like a bit of that, don't they? They varied the days and nights, and the screaming interrogations, and sometimes they strapped her flat on the stainless steel tables. It didn't matter whether she was upright or whether her head hung down over the edge of the table. Dominika resisted with all her strength, all her will. It wasn't hatred, because that would be too brittle. She cultivated disdain. She wouldn't succumb to these beasts. She refused to let them exert their will on her. They didn't look smart enough to find all the nerve bundles at the base of the coccyx or above the elbow or on the soles of her feet. But the light questing fingers never missed, and the screaming pains rocketed up her body into her head, and she heard her own ragged breath in her throat. The nerve pain was different from the tendon pain, which was different from the pain of a cable tie cinched tight around her head, across her open mouth. Dominika found that the anticipation of pain, waiting for what was next, was worse than the agonies they could generate. The glob of conductive lanolin slathered between her buttocks scared her more than the first nudge of the rounded aluminum peg they pushed into her, scared her more than feeling the electrical current, the bitter, pulsing pain, involuntary, back-arching pain that left her limp when the current stopped. One female jailer indulged in personal sport while conducting official business. Her strong hands and thick wrists were splotched by vitiligo. They lacked pigment. Strapped to a steel and canvas chair, Dominika watched the pinkish hands scuttle endlessly over her body, pressing, squeezing, pinching. The matron's eyes, they were oval like a cat's, watched Dominika's face. One Appaloosa hand lingered low on Dominika's belly, and the matron's lips parted unconsciously in agitation. The matron leaned close, her face was inches from Dominika's, her eyes questing, looking for revulsion or terror or panic. Dominika kept her face still and looked back into the darting eyes, then opened her thighs. "Go ahead, Garpaya, harpy," whispered Dominika in her face. "Go ahead and wet your sleeve." The matron straightened and slapped Dominika across the cheek. "Sorry to ruin your soggy little game," Dominika thought. The crickets clicked and she was shoved thumping against the back of the cabinets at the ends of the corridors, and the light stayed on in the cell until she could feel the sand under her eyelids, and the screeching hailer sounded like Schumann or Schubert. She couldn't tell which. A sallow girl with bruises on her legs and a crusted sore in the corner of her mouth was thrown into her cell, face first onto the floor, and she wanted to talk all night, a frightened cellmate sobbing about how she hated them. She hadn't done anything wrong. The little yellow-winged kamarechka, the canary, wanted a friend. The girl licked the sore on her mouth and looked at Dominika on her cot and put her hand out and whispered she was lonely. Dominika turned her face to the wall and ignored the raspy voice. They didn't know anything. They were looking for something to come adrift, something to pull on, but she held on tight to her secrets. They came back to the Americans. They wanted to know about her assignment to get close to Nash. Did you fuck him? Did you wrap your little sparrow beak around his cooey? Every day there would be 2 hours without the straps or the screaming or the slaps across the face that brought her head left and right and blurred her vision. A nameless colonel in formal uniform with powder blue shoulder boards that matched his halo, sensitive like Forsyth, an artist, sat across a table. She had to be careful with him. Stay alert. He spoke quietly, evenly, at the start of each session, asking why she had betrayed her country. She replied she had done no such thing, and he continued as if not hearing her, asking mildly what were the reasons she had decided to do it. What was the exact point in time that she had decided? The colonel was so mild, so assured in his manner. His questions were drawn from a premise, her guilt, that began to become a reality. Let us talk about life's disappointments, he would say, those disappointments that compelled you to do these things. Logic and fantasy and misstatements all began to invade her exhausted mind. Would you like to read the transcripts of Sinyavsky's trial? She didn't know who that was, a dissident in 1966. Read how denial evolves into acceptance, how it can liberate, said the colonel. His voice was soft, modulated. His blue bubble seemed to envelop her. Stay awake. The ancient, poisonous, and dispassionate transcripts mesmerized her. It was as if she were physically present during the show trial. She felt herself slipping. The wearisome act of denying individual accusations brought her closer to agreeing with the colonel's overarching assumption of her guilt. It was simple, really, he said. They simply had to establish how she had strayed, when, and how badly. He almost broke her, the moderate colonel in his pressed uniform, but she refused to be drawn down into their black hole. Her name was Dominika Igorova. She was a ballerina, an officer in the SVR, a sparrow trained to bend others' minds. She loved and was loved in return. She closed her eyes and flew high above Moscow, tracing the river, high above the fields and the forests, and dipped her wings over Butovo and the slit trench that held the body of Marta Yelenova, the ground frozen solid above her. Marta gave her strength, and she wrenched her mind back from the abyss. She retreated inside herself, used everything they gave her to resist them, including the hallucinations. Dominika welcomed them. She lay in her cell, and it was the bed in Helsinki, and the hot light in her eyes was the Finnish moonlight. And she lay still and felt him on top of her. The fever and the chills were his caresses. Her infected eye shed tears of love, which he kissed away. She turned on the mattress, her fists bunched under her stomach to stop the ache. Even as her arms went numb from the straps, she felt herself getting stronger. She touched the secret inside her. It had been buried deep, but she could feel it again, the secret that lived in her soul. The secret that she had stuffed away out of their reach was rekindled, began to burn again. She could think about it, knowing they could not get their hands on it. Her mother had told her to resist, fight, survive. They were getting weaker. She was getting stronger. Their individual colors were stuttering on and off, as if a fuse were loose. She told them, kept telling them, she did not do anything wrong. She couldn't tell them anything because there was nothing to tell. The louder they screamed, the happier she became. Yes, happy. She loved these men and women who tormented her. She loved the turquoise-painted colonel. They knew they could not keep on indefinitely. They were running out of time. Unless they forced a confession, they had nothing. Far above the crenellated roof of Lefortova and Lubyanka and Yasenyevo, the ether was filled with sly messages, queries and responses, precedents and deadlines. Information was coming out of Washington about the Bullard affair. The Washington Residentura had its feelers out, contacts were being taken to lunch, cooperative Americans were being met in underground garages, or on the CNO Canal towpath, or on darkened cobblestone streets in Georgetown or Alexandria. A rumor circulating out of the U.S. Justice Department held that Bullard had been under suspicion for a year before he contacted Russian intelligence in Helsinki. His arrest in Washington had been planned, but his unexpected travel abroad had forced their hand.